Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, and electronic dance music, and now heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter, at Let It Roll Cast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, Nate welcomes A.R. Shaw to discuss his book, Trap History, Atlanta Culture and the Global Impact of Trap Music. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
Time to Let It Roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and today we're joined by A.R. Shaw, the author of Trap History, Atlanta Culture, and the Global Impact. A.R., welcome.
Hi, glad to be here.
Cool, and I really dug the book, and this is obviously very timely, obviously, with the tragic death this week and the Young Thug trial, but it's an excellent history of what is now a 20-year-old subgenre of hip-hop, trap music, and very excited to have you on the show. And on the cover of the book, actually in the frontispiece of the book, you have this photograph that's of two black hands, a black man's hands, with a mic in one hand, gold watch on that hand, a handcuff on the other hand attached to the watch, and what looks like a bag of crack rock, some kind of illicit substance on the other hand. Tell us about this iconography.
Yeah, so there was initially I came up with the idea to do a book on trap music around 2014. I took a trip to London for the 2012 Olympics, and when in London, someone was, I met with one of the locals, and they told me that they were having a like this night called Trap Night. And it just kind of blew my mind away, because me being an Atlanta native, trap was just something that was, you thought that was just indicative of Atlanta and something, you know, Southern America. But to see that the influence had reached to London was, you know, it kind of just opened my eyes. And I said, okay, this is bigger than just an Atlanta thing. So I began to do my research, just, you know, from the music standpoint and also just the environment of trap, and decided to come up with a visual that kind of represented both sides of the story. And it's like this duality of one hand, you know, making it with the wealth and the mic, and using that mic to kind of elevate your status, your status in society, but also being trapped within this environment of whether it's, you know, drugs, poverty, or finding ways to get out of that. And the handcuff kind of symbolizes that, you know, they're trapped in both ways. And it's like, you know, once the artists, you know, once they enter music, they still almost become beholden to this environment and beholden to this way of life and mentality. So just wanted to kind of have a brief illustration of kind of what this overall message of what it means to be trapped, not just from a musical standpoint, but from a societal standpoint.
Yeah, and that, I mean, it seems obvious, like trap, the word trap, you know, that's what the word trap means, but it's taken on so many other meanings, first as trap house, you know, where the drugs are chopped up and distributed from, and now trap music. So I had literally stopped thinking about it as a trap, and you really bring back that literal meaning. And as we've seen this week, you know, the tragic death of Takeoff of the Migos, and the Young Thug persecution that's going on in Atlanta right now. Yeah, it really brings it back. You've got a great sentence at the beginning where you say, trap music reveals itself as the sound of young blacks feeling trapped by a lack of options and somehow viewing drugs and crime as the only way out. And that's the thing. This music from the time of T.I.'s trap music album, it's been about the drug game. And like you say, it's just become inseparable. Let's get into the specifics. You've got another quote I want to get you to elaborate on. It says, to walk in Atlanta often meant you were walking on the power of possibility. Elaborate on that.
Yeah, I think, I'll answer the second question first and then I'll come back to the first question, the first quote. With the second quote, Atlanta, walking in Atlanta, meaning Drew walking the power of possibility. Traveling, as a journalist, I got an opportunity for the past 15 years to travel across America. I've been in pretty much every major city in America. And, you know, just seeing how just the limitations that are placed on certain Black communities, well, Black communities in certain cities, you see that, you know, Atlanta, there's a different opportunity. It's the birthplace of Martin Luther King, civil rights movement. We've had multiple Black mayors, starting with Maynard Jackson in the 1970s. And so coming up under that, this historical precedent, it kind of gives you an inspiration that you probably wouldn't get from another city, being in another city where you don't have those leaders or individuals who you can look up to. And I think that Atlanta is just a special place when it comes to Black America, where you could go to the King Center, you could visit the King Center. One thing about, when we were coming up, every year we would have a school trip to the King Center. And just to walk on those grounds to say, okay, wow, this is a man who impacted the world and he comes from Atlanta. That gives you an extra motivation within itself that probably doesn't occur in most major cities. And so it's just when you walk in, there's a confidence that you have initially that you can pretty much take, if given the opportunity, you can succeed in multiple ways. On the other hand, going back to that initial quote, the first quote, regarding, trap, some youth seeing drug and crime as the only way out. Atlanta has for years been stricken with the highest income inequality rate, where you have a large gap between the wealth and the poor. And this has been consistent for decades. And so that's, although there's great opportunities for you, if you're a young Black youth coming up in that city, because you can go to Morehouse, or you can go to a Spelman or a Clark Atlanta and see that, okay, there's a way out. But at the same time, it's like from a financial standpoint, the resources a lot of times didn't trickle down to certain communities. And so if you don't have that that initial education, you know, what opportunities do you have? And so I think a lot of times you see youth not necessarily doing it just to do it. They do it because it's really the only option a lot of times but it's seen as almost the only option to find a pathway to earning finances for their family. So and with the book, I talk about how redlining and real estate, the federal government basically for years, for decades, not allowing potential black homeowners to buy in certain neighborhoods. And so you saw that, for decades, Black community was cut off from wealth. And these are the repercussions of that. And so I just wanted to make sure that I told both sides of, well, not just both sides, but all sides of the story when it comes to what trap music is and the environments that it portrays.
Well, let's go ahead and hear our first song. This is going way back. This is Hitman Sammy Sam, the Hitman. I came up strong in a tough neighborhood to battle Sammy Sam. Boy, you got to be good, because I'm a heavyweight fighter on the microphone. And the Godfather dressed like an Al Capone. And the Grand Mister stand back and pop the trunk and pull the pump on suckers who act like chump. Smooth, stand back. that was Hitman Sammy Sam, the Hitman. And a lot of people are probably going, what is this old stuff? And what does this have to do with trap? But this is a good segue. Where did trap music come from? Tell us about the influences and the longer history than we think of trap having.
Yeah, so basically, when you think about just America, I think in the 80s, crack cocaine decimated many American cities, from Los Angeles to New York to Atlanta, Miami, Chicago, Detroit. You can think about any major city in America, crack cocaine had a stronghold on them. And Atlanta was no different. And you saw early on in the 80s, a lot of the housing projects pretty much served as trap or places where drugs were sold and bought. And so, and also from a geographical standpoint, we have to go back in history. It's a historical book as well. So Atlanta, of course, was known as Terminus, and there are multiple railroads, in the city. And so what happens is you have like a lot of places where there's dead ends. It's just the way that Atlanta is geographically created is just insane. If you look at Atlanta on a grid, you will see that it kind of like the streets are like tangled. It's not really anything like very conducive. Like, you know, you go to Washington, D.C. and you see that all the streets kind of line up. And it's like you could tell that there was a meaning behind the design of Washington, D.C. But you go to Atlanta and it's like you look at the map and it's like, why are these streets so tangled and they just go nowhere? And so those places that were, you know, that the dead ends and the cul-de-sacs, those places became the trap because it was one way in and one way out in many cases. And so you get into this and you go back into the 80s. And so with the 1980s, of course, the rise of hip hop, initially bass music was the first subgenre of hip hop music that was prominent in Atlanta. And so you had guys like Hitman, Sammy Sam, Kilo Ali, Raheem the Dream. Those were like some of the first Atlanta rap artists. Hitman Sammy Sam, he was probably more so, did more street music. And so I would say he was probably like the first artist that did, like, it wasn't called trap music back then, but it was just street music or music that kind of described streets in Atlanta, the street scene in Atlanta. But the slang term trap basically grew out of that in the 1980s, where it was like places where, you know, there was only one way in and there was one way out. And so just from a slang term, those places became known as the trap. And just so, you know, this is a term in Atlanta that was around since the late 80s, during the 90s. And fast forward to T.I. made an album called Trap Music and just basically took the slang term trap and put music behind it.
And the interesting thing, like going back, I wasn't familiar with Hitman Sammy Sam or this, but listening to him, and he's got that Run DMC cadence, but he's talking about the same stuff as like Schoolie D or N.W.A. or Too Short. He's already on the gangster tip, but musically he's a little bit, and he's bass heavy. You know, you can definitely hear that Miami influence, but then his rapping style is very Run DMC, kind of mid '80s, pre Rakim style drumming. So it's pretty fascinating. But then T.I.'s album, you know, Trap Music. He called his album, his first hit album, it wasn't his first album, but it was the first album that hit for him. He called it trap music. And he and Gucci Mane have gone back and forth about, you know, who invented trap. And T.I. coined the term. And it's one of these instances. It's like house music in Chicago was called house music many years, like 5-6 years before the first house record was made, because it was based on what they were playing at a club called The Warehouse. And Frankie Knuckles was playing a certain style of music, and the Chicago production style we now know as house evolved out of that. And I'd see trap in kind of the same way, where T.I. kind of coined the genre or the ethos of the genre, but musically what he was doing kind of had more in common with what was going on in Houston or Memphis immediately prior to that. Talk about that kind of the Southern influences on T.I. and what is it? Why do we start this history with T.I. and not Outkast or the Goody Mob?
Well, in the book, I have a chapter dedicated to Outkast and Goody Mob. Fair enough. Yeah. So, it does start there. So, in the book, I actually go into when Trap was actually first recorded on an album, and it was it's two things. So, Andre 3000 said it in Players Ball. He had a lyric that said, "I set up Trap, shit up that." And that was like 1993. So that's like the first time Trap was ever heard on like a major album. Next was Cujo Goody from the Goody Mob. He mentioned the word trap on a song Thought Process, where he said, you know, when we were out serving in the trap, this was 1994. And then Big Boy said it again on the Aquemini album. This is probably on the Aquemini album, is probably like the first time most people heard Spodeyodi Dopalicious on that song. It was like a spoken word piece. Big Boy basically describes an individual who can't get a job at UPS because of failed a drug test. And it basically, at the end of the spoken word piece, Big Boy says, "Now you find yourself in a trap, just that, trapped." And so that was 98. And so that was probably the first time most people, because that was basically one of the most critics called Aquemini one of the best albums in hip hop history. And I think either Pitchfork or Rolling Stone named it the best hip hop album of all time. I can't remember which publication, but one of those publications named it.
Yeah, but yeah, I've seen that same thing. Yeah. But they didn't, you know, Outkast and Goody Mob had this more positive vibe, and that I don't associate, you know, something changed. There was a sea change around the turn of the millennium. Explain what changed.
Well, I don't think there was a change. I just think there was more so like a kind of a different story, right? I think the thing about 90s hip hop is that there were different. There was a variety of stories telling, and you know, the stories out of Miami didn't sound like the stories from Houston. The stories from Houston didn't sound like the stories from the Bay Area, and LA and Compton had a different story, and New York was just a total, you know, different monster when it came to hip hop and the variety of music, where you had a Tribe Called Quest or a Coogee Rap. Like, it was just so distinctive in hip hop in the 90s, right? But the thing about Southern music, most people didn't really know about Southern music because they didn't get national distribution. So the sound that you hear from T.I., like, he basically got a lot of his sound from UGK, the Underground Kings, 8-Ball MJG from Memphis. And so those were in the early, you know, those in the night, they didn't really get much distribution as far as, you know, national airplay. And so a lot of people didn't really know from a national standpoint. They didn't know about those underground artists. Memphis was, they had a slew of artists that were underground. Along with 3-6, they had artists such as Skinny Pimp, Gangsta Black.
Yeah, they had a thriving mixtape scene.
Yeah, Player Fly. Like, it was, but these guys, they didn't really break out on a national. Was 3-6 was like one of the only that kind of broke out nationally, but from a Southern standpoint, those were very popular albums and songs and mixtapes, and so I think T.I. gravitated towards the UGK, 8-Ball and MJG sound. Coming out of Texas and Memphis, and so I don't think it was a change. I just think that T.I. kind of gravitated towards them more so than Outkast. And you heard that. And also with Gucci Mane and Jeezy, they kind of had that same, they were kind of in that same, I guess, lane when it came to music. And so I don't know if there was a shift, but I just think it was just a different form of music. Because I think in the South, just growing up, I remember we would listen to 8-Ball and MJG, we would listen to UGK, we would listen to Outkast. Like, you know, we listen to pretty much all the Southern music, but from a national standpoint, I think a lot of people just didn't really catch on to those other artists.
Let's go ahead and hear, this is the first trap record I ever heard, T.I.'s Rubber Band Man.
Rappers like the Apollo and I'm the Sandman. Told 100 grand, got sand in the waistband. Looking for a sweet lick, but this is the wrong place, man. Every time shower, I care about a case, man. I'm campaigning to bury the haze, so say your grace, hey, man. I don't behind a sucker back, I say it in his face. I'm a thoroughbred shouter, I don't fake it, now I don't hate. Check my resume, shouter. My records and pepper. Hey, anyway.
That was T.I. doing Rubber Band Man, which is one of a wave of singles coming out of the South. You had T.I. hitting, Lil Jon was hitting with his crunk style around the same time. Houston scene was blowing up, Mike Jones and Paul Wall, and 3-6 Mafia obviously was making their national breakout. Plus the New Orleans scene was just blowing up all then. So T.I. seemed like just part of this dirty South wave that was happening. And for a lot of us that were casuals, I wasn't distinguishing, you know, who's from where and what are the different characteristics of the scene. But looking back, we have now what we call a trinity of trap artists. Hip hop's big on trinities all the way back to Kool Herc and Afrika Bambaataa and Grandmaster Flash at the beginning. Who's the trinity of trap?
Yeah, so the trinity, T.I., of course, Gucci Mane and Jeezy, who's known as Young Jeezy at that point. But T.I. was first. He was because he signed with LaFace in 98. And he came in at almost like the end of the LaFace era, the LaFace run, which was...
And I need to mention LaFace is the record company that L.A. Reid and Babyface founded. It was the first major label in Atlanta.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and artists such as TLC, Usher, Tony Braxton. So these are like... great big artist, right? So T.I., he signs in 98, signs to LaFace Records, but for whatever reason because his sound was just so different. I don't think L.A. and I have a quote in the book from L.A. Reid where, you know, he just didn't understand the music at the time. He didn't understand how to to sell it. Where he could sell a Usher and know he could get 4 million, sell really 10 million with Usher, or Outkast could sell 10 million. Tony Braxton could sell 2 or 3 million or even more. TLC would sell millions. But, you know, T.I., because the sound was so distinctive and it really wasn't a national sound at that point, his first album, I'm Serious, flopped. So he was dropped by LaFace Records. After his first album. But so T.I. was the first one to kind of introduce trap music, and Dope Boys in the Trap was kind of indicative of that that trap sound. And it's on that is that's a song on I'm Serious. Following T.I., you had Gucci Mane that came out of East Atlanta. Gucci Mane, he pretty much told stories of Zone 6 and him being raised near Boulder Crest Road. And you know, he pretty much gave his view of the east side of Atlanta, whereas T.I. was from the west side of Atlanta. And Jeezy came in. He came in around that same time, more so through the mixtape scene. Of course, he had the streets.
Explain mixtapes for listeners that don't understand. I mean, I know what a mixtape is from back in the 80s when you would record a tape at home, you know, and make up your own mix. What's it mean in the commercial context for hip hop around the turn of the millennium?
Yeah, so initially mixtapes were just songs that DJs different songs that DJs would put together for individuals who want to have a party or anything. They would sell those mixtapes, and it started in New York. It was a New York thing. But also different DJs in different cities would put together mixtapes, whether it was Chicago, of course, like you said, with House. You know, they would put together these mixtures of songs. When it came to hip hop, 50 Cent was one of the first artists to actually capitalize on the mixtape scene. Basically, he would it wasn't necessarily what we call a traditional album. It wasn't a traditionally distributed. it was basically a collection of songs that maybe freestyles or kind of like songs that you would hear. They weren't really polished, but they were just kind of experiments of songs. And basically the artist would take them right to the consumer. It wasn't really a big distribution channel. They would usually sell the mixtapes on corners or different neighborhoods, communities, you know, small record stores. And so that was pretty much how the mixtape scene was introduced in hip hop. Like I said, 50 Cent was one of the first major artists to capitalize off of that, but he was from New York. When it came to the South, he had a run of mixtapes following his being released from being released from Face Records. He came out with the In the Streets mixtape series that kind of got him back in rhythm. But Jeezy was probably one of the first artists in the South to really capitalize major on the mixtape game. First with the Streets Is Watching mixtape, and then the Trap or Die mixtape which was an entirely different thing. It had almost like a feel of an album. It was so huge. And so it was basically the artist going straight to consumer, creating a mix of songs. And instead of having a distribution channel, which was a major record label or you know, anything like that, it was like the artist would make several songs, print it up from an independent standpoint, and take it straight to the consumer.
Yeah, and at this point, it got so big, and the record companies were kind of winking at it because it was breaking big artists. I mean, somebody like DJ Screw in Houston was making a nice living just selling mixtapes out of his house. Similarly, in Memphis, all over the place. And by the early 2000s, it had become kind of quasi-legal. And it, you know, people like Lil Wayne are making these mixtapes where they're just copping beats right off records. You didn't have to clear any samples or nothing. And you know, do freestyle over it. So it very organic form. But then the record companies would have the RIAA call the cops and do these big raids. So it's just a classic case of the love-hate relationship between the artists and the community and the companies that are capitalizing on it. But I want to keep moving and talk about what changed in the 2010s. Because the 2010s, I mean, I was hearing T.I. and hearing Young Jeezy, and it still seemed like hip hop to me. It didn't seem like a distinct genre the way in the 2010s we think of, you know, Future, Young Thug, Migos. It's just audibly a different sound. Like old heads, you know, people I was listening to hip hop with in the 90s hated this stuff, called it mumble rap, and it's totally different. Let's take a break here from our sponsors. When we come back, tell us what changed in the 2010s. And we're back. So what was it that made Future Amigos so different, so just audibly different from what came before?
Yeah, the interesting thing about Atlanta when it comes in terms of hip hop is that the sound and I think the reason why Atlanta has had such a strong hold on the hip hop scene is because every 3 to 4 years, the city kind of reinvents itself, right? Where it was like most cities would have a run, and you maybe like a 2 or 3 year run, and then you wouldn't hear from them anymore. And Atlanta was different because it was like continuously, for, you know, from the day that Outkast released Southern Playalistic till this day, like Atlanta has pretty much remained at the forefront of the hip hop music scene. And you talk about the 2010s, that was almost like the shifting of guards, right? Where, of course, you had the T.I., Gucci, and Jeezy era. And now there's a shift, right? There's a shift in sound, there's a shift in style. Where you have Migos, you have Future, Young Thug. They're pretty much like the catalyst of this new sound. And Migos, they don't sound like anyone else because they come with this triplet rhyme scheme where and just to break down the triplet rhyme scheme is basically when you're rhyming two words in a within a beat, where usually it's only one word being rhymed. So it's almost like, it seems like they're moving moving faster or saying words faster than they actually are. Or it seems like, and it's like almost like they're coinciding with the snare drum beat that's really prominent in trap music. So it's almost like the voice becomes another instrument. So with, you know, the Migos, with Future, he has another sound as well. He finds a way to use autotune and just takes it to another level. And his voice is very distinctive as well. So Future was able to, you know, capitalize off of his distinctive sound. And Young Thug is just a totally different, you know, he's just like, no one sounds like Young Thug. Like, he just has his own unique sound, high-pitched voice. And, you know, that was just a change. And it was like, wow, it's a new era of not just trap music, but Atlanta music. And they're pretty much taking a mantle. And also, we got to give a shout out to the producers as well. You know, you had producers such as Metro Boomin, 808 Mafia. They were giving this trap music sound a new sound. Whereas before you had Zaytoven and Shawty Red, who worked prominently with Gucci Mane and Jeezy. And also Toomp, DJ Toomp, who worked with T.I. They were like the first producers in trap. And so, yeah, it was just an interesting thing that Atlanta was able to kind of reinvent itself in terms of trap music.
Yeah, and it's fascinating, you know, doing this project and looking at kind of the whole history of American music, Atlanta has been this underperforming city. Like, Atlanta could have, would have, should have been the home of country music. And the first big hit country record by Fiddlin' John Carson was recorded there, but Nashville gets the crown. You know, Atlanta should have, could have, would have been the home of R&B. I mean, you had, you know, Otis Redding and James Brown and even Ray Charles from Florida. None of them come to Atlanta to make their name. Ray Charles goes off to Seattle and L.A. and Little Richard goes to New Orleans. Otis Redding goes to Memphis. James Brown goes all the way to Cincinnati. And suddenly then in the 90s, Atlanta, you know, once LaFace Records comes to town, and then you have this, you know, sort of commercial R&B success and some pop hip hop like Criss Cross and stuff, and then you have Outkast and Organized Noise, and it becomes this hip hop monolith. Like you say, it just has not taken its foot off the throat of hip hop in the last 20 years. But now we're seeing this weird situation where the legal leadership of Atlanta is persecuting the top rap star and his record label. I'm talking about Young Thug being indicted by the black DA of, I want to say Fulton County, correct me if I'm wrong. Is that the right county?
Yeah, it's Fulton County. And
okay, cool.
Yeah, and the district attorney. Go ahead.
Yeah, and so as an outsider looking at this and somebody who knows American history, I mean, my assumption is just, oh man, you know, the cops are cracking down on the community again. But then you look and there's two aspects of it that freak me out. And one is that they're using lyrics of rap songs as evidence. Now, they don't go to Stephen King and use his books, which have all kinds of sick stuff in it, as evidence in a trial. You know, you don't see them going up and prosecuting, you know, Wes Craven, the director of Nightmare on Elm Street, for all the sick stuff in his movies. What's the deal with trying to prosecute rappers for the lyrics of their songs?
All right. So, yeah. So the district attorney is Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis. She was recently elected to serve as the district attorney following Paul Howard, who served as just district attorney of Fulton County for nearly 20 years, I think. It was decades. And so she upset. She was able to upset him a few years back, and she became a district attorney. And so there's two things with this YSL case. And so on the one hand, I think, and I'm a journalist first, right? So I have to always look at both sides of the story. So on one hand, I think Fannie Willis is looking at it like, okay, you know, there is a pervasive element in hip hop where it's, you know, crime is almost becoming a point where it's becoming desensitized within the communities, where you even have artists who are actually rapping about real crimes. And that was something that wasn't really the case early on in the 90s. It was very obscure. You know, it was, you know, beforehand, it wasn't really specific cases, but you actually have artists now who are actually naming individuals who were killed in rhymes. And so from that standpoint, me being a journalist, I really think that's irresponsible for any artist to pretty much indict themselves on record, right?
Yeah.
But in particular with this YSL case, I find that interesting because I've read the indictment multiple times. I think it's like 56 pages. And so just reading the indictments and the lyrics that they chose to pull from Young Thug, it's particularly Young Thug, because Ghana, actually, I'm not sure why Ghana is still in jail. It just seems like Ghana is really just guilty by association. They don't really have anything connecting a specific crime to Ghana.
Where RICO comes in. I want to ask you about
With the RICO case, of course, you know, with the RICO, and that's what they charged them with. It's almost like guilty by affiliation or association. If they can tie you to a crime organization. And so with the lyrics, I'm not sure if they're going to be able to, because, you know, just reading the lyrics, those particular lyrics seems a bit obscure and doesn't really point to a particular crime from what I've seen and just reading the different crimes. Now, individuals who they are connecting with YSL have committed crimes. And so, there was one guy who allegedly shot a police officer, I think a few months back, who was arrested, and there were several murders that took place in the city of Atlanta that the DA, they're attempting to connect to individuals who are in YSL or affiliated in some form of fashion. Now with particularly with Young Thug, I don't, you know, with the lyrics that they pulled, I don't necessarily see anything connecting with him. They're saying that there were threats that were made lyrically, but it's, to me, it's still like kind of hard to like really pinpoint that. I think the major issue that's going to pretty much derail Young Thug is he has state charges with guns. I think they found several weapons and drugs in his home during a raid. So he may have issues with that situation. Now with lyrics, you know, I've done several interviews, several articles since this case. And you're right, like hip hop is the only genre of music where lyrics are being used as evidence. There was a woman who wrote a book about how to kill her husband. I need to get the name of that. Hopefully we can go back.
I've seen that. Steph, maybe can Google that while we're talking about it.
Yeah. So there was a woman, she wrote a book called basically How to Kill Your Husband. And it's seen as art. And then later on, her husband died, right? And so, but for whatever reason, they were not going to use that book as evidence, for whatever reason. So it's just interesting that, rap lyrics are like the only entertainment. It's the only entertainment medium that's used in court cases. Even with Alec Baldwin, per se, of course, you know, he was in an unfortunate situation where someone died on set during the shooting of a film. A person died. I guess there was some type of malfunction.
Cinematographer in Baldwin was handed a loaded gun.
But there was never any, no district attorney said, oh, we're going to use Alec Baldwin's movie as an evidence to show that he has a history of violence that he, you know, would prompt him to commit this crime. It's just an interesting thing. Definitely race is involved because it doesn't really happen in other genres or any other medium forms of entertainment. And so there are several several bills. Of course, in New York, they passed a bill where lyrics can't be used in court if there isn't like a direct association with a particular crime. So they would, the prosecution would have to actually prove that the lyrics is a direct correlation to a specific crime. And so there's several bills nationwide that they're looking to pass when it comes to rap lyrics.
Yeah, I think California has one too. And unfortunately, with Georgia being Georgia, it's not quite as bad as Texas, but y'all are gonna need national legislation to get help with that. And the book, it was How to Murder Your Husband, Nancy Crampton.
Yep.
Let me introduce our third song in you. And this is Gucci Mane, Pills.
Bitch, I might be. Bitch, I might be. Bitch, I might be. Bitch, I might be.
Girl, he geeked up. Girl, he geeked up. Girl, he geeked up. Girl, he geeked up.
Bitch, I might be. Bitch, I might be. Bitch, I might be. Bitch, I might be. Yeah, I'm telling me she never sucked a dick. Never took a pill or never ate a bitch. You a lie, but I ain't gonna get upset right now. But I wish I had a lie to take a piss right now. You say you marry a bitch, you might be. But
that was Pills by Gucci Mane. And back to the thing, this Rico aspect of it. I mean, and you know, I know that hip hop isn't innocent. Like, there's a whole Hulu series on the backstories of various drug dealers and thugs that have funded or managed hip hop groups. Is there reason to believe that Young Thug's label is especially connected? Or, I mean, Rico is a heavy, heavy duty instrument. This is what they used to take down the five mafia families in New York in the 80s. And I mean, they've never had a Rico prosecution against the Ku Klux Klan, for example. So it seems pretty arbitrary. Is there something about Young Thug that, I mean, is he especially violent or especially connected, or why him? Why now?
Yeah. So, you know, what's interesting, you said that, the KKK, they've never been hit with the Rico, but there was this, it was a crew in Georgia called the Dixie Mafia. And they were like, they were like this white mafia organization in rural Georgia. They got hit with RICO charges. This is like in the 80s. So you definitely look up the Dixie Mafia, and they committed a lot of crimes, and they were probably one of the first organizations in Georgia to get hit with RICO charges. But with Young Thug, it's very interesting when it comes to, you know, it's just when you're raised in certain communities, is, you know, you almost can't really, a lot of times you don't really choose your friends. You basically become friends with individuals who are go to school with you, or if they play sports with you, those are usually the people who become your friends. And they, you know, from childhood, those are usually your friends throughout life. Young Thug was raised on in this area on a street called Cleveland Avenue, which was a lot of crime during his youth in that area. And so I'm sure, you know, he had friends who were who had pretty much gone into maybe a life of crime. And so a lot of times, you know, with artists, they usually keep those same guys around, unfortunately. And it's, you know, because it's like, you know, you pretty much associate with the individuals who you know, the individuals who you trust, the individuals who you've been around since you were a kid. And so a lot of times when it comes to Black artists, prominent artists, they're still affiliated with individuals who still may still live a life of crime. And if there are several individuals who are surrounding you who live that life, you can be guilty by association with the RICO Act. Young Thug had his issues early on. I mean, he's definitely been arrested before, but I mean, for the past, I guess, you know, since I've covered him since, you know, 2012, 2013, his initial rise in rap. And he's pretty much kept himself clean throughout his journey and his rise in hip hop. my thing is that it seems like from what I'm reading in the app, from my reading of the affidavit, is that a lot of it is just that they've been caught up in this unfortunate circumstance where a lot of their friends and individuals who they're still affiliated with are committing crimes. And so, you know, the district attorney has found a way to basically tie all of those people in. And so it's the trial starts in January 2023. And so it's going to be interesting to see what comes out during that trial.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely going to be watching it closely, and it's I'll be interested to see what evidence she has. But at this point, I'm pretty infuriated. It's just outrageous. And Gunna in particular, he's sitting in jail, right? He can't even get bail. And what's he even specifically accused of?
Yeah, the Gunna situation is very perplexing. I don't really understand why Gunna is still. Well, I don't even understand. I didn't initially understand why Gunna was arrested in the first place. Well, from what the district attorney is saying is that that if they release him, that he may intimidate witnesses, which I doubt. I highly doubt. That's gonna happen.
I mean, I'm sorry, but I don't think he could intimidate me. Like,
yeah, he's. I mean, Gunn is a cool kid. I've interviewed him several. Actually, I gave him his first cover story. I wrote his first cover story in 2016. It was years ago, but yeah, I interviewed him for his first national cover story. And of course he comes from those communities where there's individuals who committed crimes, but Gunna's really, he's a good dude. Like overall, he's a good dude. And I'm just really perplexed at why I don't understand why he's still in jail, while the trial is going on. Like, it's interesting that, they say that, they're using, I don't know, some type of evidence that, they think that he's going to, I don't know, he's a flight risk because he has money and, he can intimidate witnesses. But from what I'm seeing right now, it doesn't seem as if Gunna will be convicted. I don't see how they're going to get a conviction with Gunna in particular.
Yeah, I don't either, but taking a year out of a young man's life and artistic, at the prime of his career, especially with COVID ending and he could be getting back on the road and making some money, he can't get this back. I mean, they're doing irreparable harm. And, this reminds me of what happened to Stax Record in Memphis, where they made some management decisions on their own, got a little overextended on the cash, had some trouble with a distribution deal with Columbia. But fundamentally, it was banks in Memphis and the IRS that shut them down and killed what was the second biggest Black-owned business in the country at the time. And Memphis has still never recovered. I mean, and so I just wonder what this DA is thinking, if she's even cognizant of the threat she's presenting, to one of Atlanta's biggest industries right now. It's scary. But let's go ahead and hear our fourth song. This is the Migos, and listen for that trademark triplet flow that they cut. This is Versace. Versace head on me like Illuminati. I know that you like it. Versace, my neck and my wrist is so sloppy. Versace, Versace, I love it. Versace, the top of my Audi. My blogger, John Gotti, he give me the dozen. I know that they mighty. Gotti. Whoa. I mean, I just love the Versace store. Versace, 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 Versace. That was Versace, the first big record for the Migos, featuring their patented triplet flow, which has become incredibly widespread. And one thing that's really gotten my attention, as somebody who, I'm kind of a golden old dude, a golden age of hip hop fan who kind of checked out for a long time, I've been following it more closely since I've been doing this project, and all the old school rappers trashing these young rappers and calling it mumble rap. What's the deal with this? Because why do Migos in particular, Kodak Black's another one that gets hit with this. Why is there such a backlash from the old heads against this style of rapping?
Well, it's interesting. I have a section in the book, The Art of Mumble Rap, And I don't really go as deep as I could have gone, but I kind of touch on it. And it's actually in the Migos chapter, at the end of the Migos chapter, I call it The Art of Mumble Rap. And it's just a generational thing. I think, every generation, for whatever reason, the generation that came before just thinks that it's just the most horrific music ever. If you go back to the 50s, even early on, they thought that, early rock and roll was just going to be the end of civilization. So, and even with jazz, was banned in a lot of places. So there's always been this backlash against youth movements. And it's not unique to me that that hip hop went through that same phase when it came to trap music and mumble rap. Particularly, I think the biggest thing is this, right? I think when it comes to youth, they talk to each other, right? And it's kind of like the Charlie Brown thing, right? Where Charlie Brown cartoon, yeah. the adults are really like, it's very indecipherable. It's like, this weird sound. But the only language that you hear in Charlie Brown is the conversations between the kids, right?
Yeah.
And that's what happens with music, right? Like music, artists are only talking to their peers. They're not talking to anyone who are not their peers. So it's like, if there's an older school rapper who's like, I don't understand mumble rap. Well, the artist's probably not talking to you. they're talking to the people who are in their generation, and the people in their generation understand them. So that's the deal with when it comes to music and like a backlash. And it's always going to be that way. I think even the mumble rappers now, whatever comes after that, they may go back and say, oh, this is not real music. So it's just always going to happen where, that generational divide when it comes to music, because, we always think that, the music of our youth, the music that we listened to when we were teens and when we were in college, that's always going to be the best music ever, regardless of whatever you experience after. I grew up.
I can objectively tell you Public Enemy is the height of human musical accomplishment. So
yeah, we can stop there. That's just what it is. I mean, I grew up on Outkast, and there's nothing I'm going to experience that's going to be equivalent to what I experienced as a youth growing up and listening to Outkast. So even though I respect, what's happening now, I don't downgrade them because I look at it as art and as storytelling. But there's never going to be a moment that was bigger than the Outkast run for me. So I just understand it's just a generational divide.
And one last thing, topic I want to hit. Obviously, there's the tragedy in Houston this week where Takeoff, a.k.a. Kershnick Ball, was killed in Houston. But you tell several stories of rappers we haven't heard about who are on the beginnings of very promising careers. And in particular, you tell the story of Slim Duncan, Doe B, and Bankroll Fresh. Pick one of those stories and just give a quick capsule telling the story of one of those.
Yeah, I go, man, it's, and so just for context, in the book, I have a chapter called, what's the chapter called? It's called Rap's Death Trap. I'm not sure why I got a brain flaw, but it's called Rap's Death Trap. And it's,
sorry, I had my mute button on, or I would have jumped in and helped you. I was trying.
Yeah, it's Rap's Death Trap, and it basically goes into the numerous deaths that occur in hip hop over the past decade, and it's just sad, and it's on all fronts. I'll take Doe B. I think with Doe B, to me, is like all of them have different unique stories and the way they were introduced to rap. But to me, Doe B was like, it was interesting because he comes from Alabama, right? He comes from Mobile, Alabama, and Alabama really doesn't have a hip hop scene at all. Like, I can't remember the last prominent hip hop artists to come from Alabama, right? There are a few artists now that are coming up just more recently over the past year, but before that it was, Alabama just hadn't really had a real moment to shine. And you know, out of all the Southern states, you know, whether Tennessee had a moment to shine, even Mississippi had, you know, David Banner and Big Crit, you know, Florida, of course, North Carolina, you know, had a movement. But Alabama was, you know, we just didn't really hear much from Alabama. And Doe B was that guy that could have really taken Alabama to a national stage and pretty much could have created an industry that's lacking there, right? Because you got to think about when a hip hop artist shines from a community, they pretty much, you know, create infrastructure in that community. You know, you create jobs, you create, you know, opportunities for local DJs, for local graphic designers, for individuals who probably wouldn't have opportunities in other cities. You know, once an artist, you know, blows up nationally, it helps the entire infrastructure of a city. And so you think about someone like Doe B who came up in Mobile, and I'm just like, wow, man, this is the guy. And I remember just his early on thing. Of course, Doe B was signed to T.I.'s Grand Hustle label, and he had a unique flow and a unique style. And it was like, oh, this is the guy. Like, this is the guy that can actually put Alabama on a map, right? And it was just like, you know, I had followed him, and I remember just, you know, going to several mixtape parties with him. Grand Hustle had a mixtape where he was featured prominently on multiple songs. I think it was a song called Wokim Osabi. And he just like, you know, if you get a chance, definitely Google or YouTube, you know, Wokim Osabi. And Dobie, just his flow is just so unique. And he's just like, man, this guy is really good. Unfortunately, and during that time, I, you know, working as a reporter, I had a colleague who was from Mobile, Alabama, and he, you know, he moved to Atlanta to work and to get into the industry. But, you know, he was just telling me just like how at a disadvantage he was growing up, because he was like, you know, his only dream was just to get to Atlanta. This is my colleague, right? He's like, he was just praying to find a way to get to Atlanta, because he was like, you know, if he stayed in Mobile, Alabama, like, he didn't know where his life was going to go. Like, he says, there's no opportunities there. It's just, you know, poverty, no real industry. It's just nothing there, right? And so I was like, wow. And so, you know, unfortunately, Doe B, he goes back to celebrate, goes to Mobile, Alabama to celebrate, you know, his success as a young artist. And, you know, unfortunately, that's jealousy. You know, that was just an individual who was jealous of his success because he was the one who made it. And I think, you know, those individuals saw like, wow, this is the guy they wanted to be. I really think they just wanted to be in his shoes because they knew that they couldn't get to his level. They had no way out. They were really trapped. And so that's another repercussion of trap, where it's like individuals who envy the success of others. And, you know, for whatever reason, for whatever traumatic issues that they haven't really been able to express, you know, their mental health, you know, facilities in most communities where individuals can really express themselves and really understand, you know, and deal with the trauma they've grown up in. And so they killed Doe B. And, you know, it's just like, you know, and it was just over something so petty. It was just jealousy of this guy made it out. And, you know, the guys who killed him knew that they couldn't get to his level. And it was just, you know, it was just a sad situation. We drove down to Mobile. I drove with my coworker to Mobile, the guy who was from Alabama. We drove down to Doe B's funeral. And just riding through that community, man, and I saw, like, I'm just like, wow, man, it's just like, it's nothing here. Like, it's just like desolate. It's like, you know, if you don't, I don't know what, you know, you're literally, there's, like I say, it's literally a trap where there aren't any jobs. Like, where are you going to work? You know, the local Walmart, like, you know, unless you can, you know, find a way, you know, of course, you know, a lot of the schools aren't really good, so they're not really giving you a proper education. But if you don't get that proper education and find a way to, you know, to get into a university or learn a trade, you know, there's nothing for you to do. There's nothing, there's no resources for you to succeed. And so, yeah, that Doe B situation really struck me hard, because it was like, this was the guy that could have turned the tide for Alabama. You know, with Alabama being next to Georgia, it's like, you know, you want a city, you want a state like Alabama to have similar success of Atlanta because it helps the economy, you know. And if, you know, someone like Dobie could get on, he can go back and maybe, you know, start a record label and put some of his friends on and put some of his, you know, because in a bit, you know, some of his friends to work. And maybe there's another artist that can come up after him or another DJ that can come up after him. And that's the trickle down effect of hip hop. It's like, you know, this music creates industries, right? Like Atlanta is an industry. Like there are people who are getting paid from the hip hop industry that don't actually rap, that don't make beats, that don't have anything to do with the music per se, but they are able to live a life based off of this industry. You know, I'm a journalist and I've been a journalist for 16 years. I don't just cover hip hop, but for the most part, I've been able to have a great living just covering hip hop or, you know, being able to interview artists and things of that nature. And I have friends who are photographers who take photos of concerts and take photos of the artists. And, you know, they get paid for that. And I have graphic designers, individuals who do social media. So I think when we look at hip hop, you know, don't just look at the music, just look at the infrastructure that it creates and jobs and employment opportunities that come with the success of an artist in the city.
Absolutely. And my guest has been A.R. Shaw. I'm Nate Wilcox, and the book is Trap History, Atlanta Culture and the Global Impact of Trap Music. A.R., thanks so much for coming on and catching us up on the scene in Atlanta.
But thanks so much for having me.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Monday, Nate welcomes Annie Zaleski to talk Duran Duran's Rio. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com.